On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the Cubs are hot. The Braves are hot, too. The Mets are getting hotter. And the Phillies are frigid. We'll do good, bad, ugly with some dusting your surfaces discourse. And talk about how you should not go out to pitch when it's not your turn. It's a fun episode. At least I certainly think so. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks Wrigley Field should be changing the lyrics to Bro, Cubs. Whoa. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. You win this many games in a row, and an update might be in order.
Hey, Chicago, what do you say? The Cubs haven't lost in a while. Is that maybe also a possibility for the new lyrics? As the Cubs complete an undefeated homestand, giving their fans a lot of reason to sing that cheesy song that we love so much. And that is why the Chicago Cubs are our opener.
Nine in a row. That's hard to do. The Chicago Cubs are on one, completing the third mop of this MLB season, a four-game drubbing of the Philadelphia Phillies at home midweek, capping it off yesterday afternoon with a hilarious 8-7 outlasting, in which not a lot went right for them, but they won the ball game. Anyway, the Cubbies are 16-9. They are tied atop the NL Central with the Cincinnati Reds. And they are the hottest team in the sport right now.
Yeah, and we thought it was only fair. We've spent a lot of these early season episodes looking and pointing and laughing at the teams that were on these long losing streaks. And we could still do that. The Phillies, of course, continue to lose, and they are the other part of this equation here with the Cubs. Some other teams certainly struggling, but it's time we kind of spin some positive energy forward and celebrate the teams who are playing quality baseball. This winning streak, though, for the Cubs is pretty funny because of who it has come against. It is not just that they just mopped the Philadelphia Phillies, a four-game sweep at home. Before that, they swept the New York Mets at home, and before that, they won two games against the Phillies in Philadelphia by a score of 10-4 and 11-2. So this nine-game winning streak has come against just two teams. They will now be tested in a much more meaningful way as they head west and have a nice little road trip at the Dodgers and at the Padres. But this does seem, whether it's just beating up on the Phillies and Mets or not, what is going right for the Cubs? Because your plus 43 run differential, which is the third best mark in baseball behind the Dodgers and the Braves. And I think it's important to recognize that there's some problems going on in Chicago. There are some things that they are overcoming. In some respects, that isn't surprising, because what is going well for the Cubs right now are the things that I think we were counting on. This offense is now almost fully healthy, and the defense has been elite. Now, the pitching, let's move the pitching to the side for a second, because there's a lot of weird stuff going on there. They're certainly missing a lot of arms. But now that they have Seiya Suzuki back and really starting to swing it, now that Michael Busch has homered twice since I asked him why he hasn't homered yet, now that Bregman, I mean, his underlying stats have been good the whole season, finally starting to come out of it. And then we got to start talking about some of the newer faces like Moises Ballesteros and whatnot. And then Nico Horner's been one of the best players in the National League. So they have a lot going right on offense. I think we should maybe start there.
Well, if I had told you that the Cubs were going to win nine in a row in April, I don't think you would have said that the three worst regulars on the team would be, you know, MVP vote recipient P. Crow Armstrong, enormous free agent acquisition Alex Bregman, and last year, I assume, home run leader Michael Busch. Like, those have been the three worst offensive regulars for this team. And those are the three guys that maybe PCA is a little different, but the guys, at least Busch and Bregman, like, you felt the best about them producing offensively. And so to see the second level Cubs kind of step up and be a huge part of the offense, in my opinion, is really encouraging. because particularly with Bregman and Bush, like, I think those guys are going to bounce back and finish the season with lines that are in line with their career norms. PCA may be a bit of a different story, but Carson Kelly on fire, Nico Horner probably deserved to be mentioned earlier when I said Cubs I expected to be really good. He is one of the Nico Horner discourse is its own conversation. The fact is, what a phenomenal baseball player he has turned into. Ian Happ doing what Ian Happ always does. But then, like, Matt Shaw been pretty good when Seiya Suzuki was out. Seiya Suzuki been pretty good since he got back. And then Moises Ballesteros has raked for the Cubs.
Yeah, and Ballesteros, they have kept him pretty much entirely in a platoon role. I believe he's only faced like two or three left-handers the entire season. But whatever. If you're going to produce to this degree when you are getting these opportunities, and we even saw that at the end of last year when he got called up, this dude has raked his whole life. And because he looks the way that he does and might not have a position, this is not a situation where I know they want to keep it's a version of the Ben Rice thing where they keep saying, like, no, he's a catcher. We want him to catch. He's a long-term catcher. And yes, that would, of course, increase his value very much. But when he's hitting the way that he is, you just kind of find a way to get him into the lineup in favorable matchups, and you kind of ride that. I'm sure there are some Cubs fans that are probably like, why isn't this dude hitting all the time? Now that Suzuki's back, there's not as many at-bats necessarily to go around offensively or at the DH spot. I am curious how they continue to fit Shaw into the rotation because of how well that he has been playing. But these are good problems to have. And Ballesteros has given them exactly what you could have possibly hoped for one of the few new guys. I know Bregman is, of course, the real new one, but if you consider him effectively a replacement of Kyle Tucker, then Ballesteros is really the fresh blood in this lineup that we haven't really seen a lot of. And he's been so much fun to watch, and I'm excited that he's really getting that opportunity.
Do you see the goose, by the way? See the goose discourse? Goose chat?
No.
Or a little- no? Little Wrigley Field goose action. This was on, I think, the first game of the set. There was a goose just like perched in shallow left field, and Michael Bush singled like at the goose, and then the goose flew away. Oh. And it just made me realize that Wrigley Field has more animal appearances, it feels like, than any other ballpark. Right, I feel like we're getting squirrels, cats, geese, obviously the billy goat. And I was thinking about this for a while, like, what about Wrigley makes it particularly amenable to wildlife? And it dawned on me, dude, the outfield wall is nature.
You think it's attracting more wildlife than normal just because of the
I think so.
Of the natural instead of the normal padding it. I don't think that's the point of the ivy, but you might be onto something there. And any clips involving wildlife scrambling out of the way of live baseballs is usually pretty funny. This is for the best when they do successfully avoid them, unlike other cases,
unlike that one time
in baseball history. Like that one. Wait, time.
Wasn't that also at Wrigley Field?
Which one are you talking about?
No, Randy Johnson killing the bird was in spring training.
Yes.
And then there was the other one in, I think it was in Toronto. Is it Gary Sheffield killed a bird or Dave Winfield
there
killed
have been,
a bird? You keep
there. Randy Johnson gets all the attention, but there have been other instances in baseball history of such. Thankfully, it seems like this goose was just fine. And yeah. The Cubs, everything's going right for the home team in Chicago, which makes sense. I think the one other guy I want to mention before we switch to the pitching, which has been very strange, but deserves credit in and of itself. I just want to talk about Ian Happ. This dude is, first of all, I mean, this is one of the best starts he's had to a season. He has been one of the more reliable players in the entire league in terms of what he's getting. And because he never gets above that or below that, we don't really talk about him. But he's played at least 148 games in each of the past five seasons and has essentially put up the exact same slash line with almost the exact same counting stats every single year. And now he's already had some of the biggest swings this season. His on base is, his on base and slugging are both at career high marks. Obviously a switch hitter and one of the longest tenured Cubs. And Hap is the one that I think about, you know, when I spent some time with the Cubs in spring training. The, of course, there was excitement of Bregman arriving and whatnot, but Hap, because he's in the final year of his contract, is really the face of what this season, how important this season is. Now, since they have extended Nico Hoerner, who was also entering last year of his contract, so that's another one that they know this infield is going to stay together. But there are a lot of pieces on this roster that we do not know what their future is in Chicago in the final year of their deal. Hap is, I think, first and foremost because of how long he's been there, but that also includes Seiya Suzuki. That includes, now as we shift to the mound, that includes Shota Imanaga. That includes Matthew Boyd, who has a mutual option. That includes Jameson Taillon. That includes a lot of the other pitchers. And so I think that the Cubs are recognizing this as both an opportunity, not necessarily full-blown last dance, because they do still have some core pieces in place and a lot to look forward to. But I think that they recognize that this is a really, really important season for the whole organization. And I would love to see whether Ian Happ gets extended again or not. I love to see him in the center of their success, because he's just been there through essentially from as soon as after they won the World Series, Ian Happ has been there, you know, trying to get them back to glory. So, and he's, you know, obviously one of our favorite dudes off the field as well.
He is such a fascinating character. I have a soft spot in my heart for the non Hall of Fame level player that spends their entire career in one place, like over 10 years, right? 10 or more. Like Brett Gardner, for as I guess much of a pest as he was to watch, I love that, like, he's not getting a plaque in Cooperstown. He was just a Yankee, right? It's easy to throw some dudes on a pedestal who, like Joey Votto will be in the Hall of Fame. He's like, oh, he's always with Reds. It's great. Like, if you were, like, really good but not elite, and you stay in one place, I think that's rad. Like Adam Jones, I know Adam Jones spent that one weird year in Arizona at the end.
Yeah.
And I guess was up with Seattle at the beginning. But, like, he's an example of this. Alex Gordon is another player of ilk.
Yeah, I know he didn't play as long as those guys, but, I mean, Kyle Seager is, like, squarely in that conversation, just perfectly. Yeah. I know his career ended a little bit sooner. Now you're bringing this up about Hap. I mean, Hap clearly has a lot more to give, and that's why I'm curious where this goes, if they do find a way to extend him again, if he fits into their plans moving forward. But right now, whether they're negotiating that behind the scenes or not, he's just so important to their success. And it's cool. It's cool to see him be a main character in a part where they've brought in these other bigger names. Of course, Dansby Swanson, who's having a really interesting, strong start to the season. Now Bregman, some of the guys that have come up that are also homegrown, like PCA and whatnot. So I'm just, you know, I'm a big Hap fan. Okay, so let's talk about the pitching, because this is the part where 9 games ago is really when the pitching started to fall apart from a durability standpoint. They lose Cade Horton to season-ending elbow surgery, which is devastating. Matthew Boyd was on the injured list briefly. Daniel Palencia, the, you know, Team Venezuela hero, and was off to a great start as their closer, he's on the injured list as well. And so how are they doing this? How are they getting outs? We know, first and foremost, they have an elite defense, and that has translated pretty much immediately all around the diamond, whether that is Hoerner and Swanson and, of course, PCA. And by the way, Matt Shaw has been, like, looks pretty – I don't know how he's graded, but I've seen him make a good number of nice plays in the outfield. So we know they're good defensively, but how are they doing this on the mound? I mean, Imanaga and Edward Cabrera are huge parts of this. Both of those guys have – pretty much given you exactly what you could hope, considering they brought brought Imanaga back, brought in Edward Cabrera in the offseason. Imanaga in particular, it's amazing how much better he looks at 92 instead of like 90 and a half. He's not throwing 96 suddenly, but it is a huge difference. And you can tell that velo's there, that fastball is playing, and just everything looks a lot better with Imanaga. But the bullpen is about as anonymous as you're going to get, especially behind Valencia. Now Caleb Thielbar just got hurt. That's the part that's amazing to me.
So let's talk about the bullpen, because there are a lot of names that are not household, unless you are, you know, Phil Maton's parents, but the Cubs are without some important pieces. That is Palencia, Phil Maton, Hunter Harvey, who they went out and got this winter to throw important innings. Shelby Miller, who is on this team, I learned apparently he's not pitched yet for them. And then now Caleb Thielbar looks hurt. And so it's been like a lot of Riley Martin and Jacob Webb and Hobie Milner and the ever mercurial Ben Brown. Mm-hmm. Do I think this will last? Maybe. I think that having an elite defense helps weather this type of thing more than if you don't. Freaking duh. But it is an important dynamic here because you're able to search out and find, let me back up. It's harder to find dudes with swing and miss stuff that you can just like pop in here, right? But you can find and bring up dudes who are less likely to walk hitters, who are relying more on turning balls in play into outs. And if no one's doing that better than the Cubs, it makes it easier to kind of backfill some of those injuries.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And Hobie Milner certainly embodies that from a funk standpoint. But even some of their starters on the back end, like Colin Ray, right? I mean, that's a guy that isn't blowing anybody away, but he knows how to get outs.
I think we should wrap it up with a little Edward Cabrera talk, because he gave a hilarious quote after yesterday's win when he said, "This is the best team I've been a part of. I haven't been on a team like this before." Edward Cabrera, who is on the Marlins.
I do believe that, and shout out to the Cubs interpreter Freddie, one of my favorite Cubs PR people or PR people in baseball. I believe that he also said in the quote, acknowledging, like, "Oh, I've only been on two teams. Like, I know that this is, it's not like I've this is my 15th year and I've played for seven teams," but he's like, "This is awesome. This is so much fun. Oh my God, we have so many good baseball players." And yeah,
there are people in the stands every day.
There's a lot of people here. They're getting really excited when think about just what Edward Cabrera's been watching. I know Marlins fans listening, I'm sorry, but think about the Go Cubs Go. Think about this undefeated homestand and him watching the crowd reaction, not just during these wins, but after these wins, and what this environment is like.
Packed at a day game. He's got to be having a blast. This is why Wrigley is special. It's special there, man. And like when there are butts in seats during games where you don't think there will be, it is a legitimate boost. Players like playing in front of fans. I know that sounds stupid, but it is very true. And I've talked to guys who've played in Miami. After they leave, they're like, "Wow, I didn't realize how important that was, or what the other side was like." Now, obviously they play games on the road where their stands are packed, but like, it's a different dynamic. So it's cool for Cabrera to, you know, explain that. The Cubs this weekend go to Dodger Stadium for an ultimate test against the two-time defending champions, Jameson Taillon against Emmett Sheehan on Friday night. That is tonight. Colin Ray against Roky Sasaki. Oh, ball one from Roky. That'll be on Saturday. Imanaga against Wroblewski on Sunday. Oh, ball two from Roky. This will be a good series. I will be ball three for Roky. I'll be tuned in to as many of these as I can. And that'll be a walk as Michael Busch leads things off against Roky with a four-pitch walk. Okay, before we take a break, I do briefly want to chat about the Braves, who I spent some time around this week. So we'll do a little field report. Over the winter, when the Braves decided to hire Walt Weiss as their new manager, Weiss, who had served as the bench coach under Brian Snitker for a long while, there was some criticism, both within the Braves fan base and outside it, that the move was too continuous, that it was a continuation of what had always been, that it felt almost fait accompli, that they were just handing the torch to the guy who had been there all along. And while I think some of that criticism was fair, what I learned this week and what I had kind of gathered from spending a lot of time around the Braves over the last, you know, number of years, Walt Weiss and Brian Snitker are very different people. They are very different leaders, and they are very different managers. The Braves are the best team in the sport right now. They have the best record. They have scored the most runs. They have allowed the second fewest runs per game. And the best run differential. They're 18-8. They already have a 5-game lead in the NL East over the Miami Marlins, who are not over 500. I was very impressed. This team is playing very well, and they're playing well despite Acuna and Riley being very blah and injuries to a lot of their important arms, and Jurickson and Profar deciding to spend too much time with that good PED stuff over the winter. So the Braves are real, dude. They're really real.
Yeah, and when I did my first power rankings a couple weeks ago, they had already shown me enough that I put them all the way up at number two behind the Dodgers. This weekend will be an interesting opportunity, not just for the Braves to continue winning. Remember, they have still yet to lose a series this season. The only team that can say that. They will welcome the Phillies to Atlanta, which we could touch on the Phillies again here briefly before we take a break. But also the series we just mentioned, Cubs and Dodgers. And if the Dodgers can kind of stomp out the Cubs, maybe they stay ahead of the Braves. If the Cubs go in there and take care of the Dodgers, okay, maybe and the Braves win another series, okay, maybe the Braves are in that number one spot next week. We can talk about that on Monday. But similar to the Cubs and obviously the Dodgers too to a degree, you kind of laid out the simple stats, but you look at just how many different things the Braves are doing well right now, it's hard to deny. And even with knowing that there is still upside with some of those key players, there's also some, okay, how long can they keep getting away with this on the mound? But I do think that, especially on offense, let's talk about we've the seen pitching. Enough that is to feel good about.
Let's talk about the pitching. So, you know, they lose Schwellenbach and Strider in spring training. Strider's on his way back. He's throwing 98 in rehab starts. That is very encouraging. He should be back soon. They got a wonderful outing the other day from J.R. Richie making his big league debut, allowing a home run on the first pitch he ever threw to James Wood, which is very rare. It happens like once a season. First time that happened to a Brave since 1977. Welcome to the big leagues, buddy. But then he settled in. It was great. I do not think the Martin Perez show will continue for much longer. I will say, and I've been fooled by this before, and I've been low on this guy for a long time, Bryce Elder looks like a different pitcher. And for all of the things going on with the Braves that are new, that is the one I think I buy the most. I don't buy Mauricio Dubon hitting like this. Dom Smith might be a quality DH, but he's not going to have a 175 OPS plus the whole time. Michael Harris looks really good, but I think he at some point will have his slump where he chases a lot. But Bryce Elder is just throwing so many more sliders than he has in the past. I think that is probably a product of a new, more forward-thinking pitching coaching staff led by Jeremy Hefner, who is the pitching coach in New York for a long time. Number two there, JP Martinez, did a lot with a little in San Francisco for a long time. And I think that those changes will stick. Like, will Elder have a 150 all year? No. But I think he can be in the rotation and contribute for a lot of the season. On that front, I felt really encouraged. And the last point I want to make is about Walt Weiss, who I find to be a fascinating character where, you know, obviously we all saw him tackle Jorge Soler. And I think when you see Walt Weiss in person, you look at his stature and you're like, that is a man to not be trifled with. That is a physical presence. His forearms, they have forearms. And I think it kind of gets at what makes him different than Snitker. He brings an edge. He brings an FU. He brings a more constant presence. When I was talking to players in the Braves about this, a lot of them were hesitant to like compare and contrast the two because they didn't want to criticize Snitker. And it's like hard to compliment Weiss without criticizing Snitker. But just my general sense, Weiss is a little bit more forward thinking when it comes to analytics. He's a little bit more present and more of a motivator. And obviously he has the edge that comes from being the guy who tackled Jorge Soler. Michael Harris described him to me as, quote, he's the big bad wolf, which I thought was just beautiful.
A couple more things on the Braves, then we should acknowledge the Phillies continue to lose, and then we'll take a break. The one thing with the Braves that I'm not feeling good about is Reynaldo Lopez. And that's one that, you know, when he first gets to Atlanta, how good he looks in 24 was unbelievable. He was one of the best pitchers in baseball, even though he was only 135 innings. Last year, of course, is injured for much of it. He just doesn't look right. I mean, this stuff just isn't there. The performance hasn't been there. Bryce Elder's mini breakout kind of offsets that, but Lopez is just not one. Like, that's one where it's really important for Strider to get back soon. Hurston Waldrop, another arm that's been out. I don't know how soon he's expected back. I think that's a longer-term thing as well. But that's the Lopez one I'm not feeling awesome about. That said, the thing that's going so well on the mound, too, the bullpen. You say, okay, well, why did they sign Iglesias and then also Robert Suarez? Well, here comes Raisel Iglesias. He's 36. He's on the injured list for even a little bit of time. You've got this other comfortable closer that you can just slot into the ninth. No trouble at all. Robert Suarez has been doing that for a long time. And these other lesser-known relievers, Dylan Lee, Tyler Kinley, have been terrific. So a lot going right there. And then the last thing we just have to – I mean, Drake Baldwin is incredible.
He's a player, man.
Everything he did last year as a rookie was legit. Like, he won Rookie of the Year. This isn't some big secret. But I think it was the underlying stuff, and this was true in AAA also, why I was so confident that he could be an impact player even last season, maybe not to that degree. It's some of the best of the sport. He looks like one of the best hitters in baseball, and that's only continued. He's only gotten better this season. So
he has the most hits.
Just
no one has more hits.
Has more hits. No one has more runs. No one has more runs scored than Drake Baldwin, which is
kind of the point of the game.
That's why you play the game. Scoreboard right now. It does leave Sean Murphy, who's still coming back from injury. Like, what is Sean Murphy now? I have no idea how to even talk about him, that's an expensive backup catcher. But again, good problems to have. You'd rather have Drake Baldwin than not. They will figure that out. So the Braves are very, very, very good. As for the Phillies,
catastrophe. Very bad. The Phillies, look, it's still April. Phillies could be killed off this weekend. Braves sweep the Phillies this weekend, and like, it could be ugly. Phillies straight up released Taijuan Walker after another horrendous start against the Cubs. They called up Garrett Stubbs from AAA with JT Realmuto going on the IL. This team can't hit a lick if your name's not Schwarber or Harper or Brandon Marsh or Justin Crawford. But that leaves five hitters that are very bad. And I'm worried. I am way more worried about the Phillies than the Mets. Way more worried about the Phillies than the Mets.
Yeah. And well, certainly easy to say that after the last couple of days. The Phillies,
but
as
I said
you
it before,
go to Atlanta.
I said it before.
No, it's true.
Said it before the Mets.
That's true.
Said it before the Mets won. Yep. Okay.
Totally valid.
Couple words in my mouth.
I just want to, just a little schedule game here. So at Braves, that's not awesome. Then their next series are Giants, Marlins, A's, Rockies, Red Sox. They kind of stink too. Pirates, yep. Reds, whatever. So, you know, once again, if you're looking for, just as we are doing with the Mets right now with their schedule, okay, how do you get back to 500? You play some teams that you should be able to take care of. It might get worse before it gets better. I'm not burying the Phillies quite yet, but they are going to be in quite a hole, which is not awesome. Not awesome, folks. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, Lucas Giolito is employed? We'll be right back.
Got it. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It's a beautiful Friday. And one of our pals has a job. Let's go around the league. It's probably uncool and unfair to judge a book by its cover. But Lucas Giolito looked unemployed with the beard and the hair. Not anymore, baby. As he shaved, he trimmed, and he got himself a job. Our favorite woke bum signs a one-year, $3 million deal with the San Diego Padres, joining a staff that has in need of some reinforcements. And Lucas, there's a one-year contract with a mutual option, 2027. Mutual options are the most worthless, pointless thing in the sport. They never get picked up by either side. But here we are. Lucas, job.
Yeah, in this case, the mutual option is also just like a mechanism to give him more money when it gets bought out, pretty much, as opposed to picked up for next year. But forget about it. Let's talk about the here and now. He did it. He found a team to sign him. And this was kind of the one that was in the small circle of teams that made the most sense from the beginning. This was a team, I think, at the beginning of the offseason, we could have said, hey, you know who would make a lot of sense for Lucas Giolito? The San Diego Padres. They went about a very quiet offseason where they spent almost nothing and made zero trades. And we said, okay, well, Lucas is going to be out of their price range. They end up bringing in Walker Buehler and Germán Márquez and Griffin Canning. But because they have some injuries to start the season, even with the delightful breakout of Randy Vasquez and Michael King's been looking pretty solid. They paid Michael King to come back, which was obviously most of their budget, it seemed like, for the winter. But Lucas was holding out for a deal he thought was more fair for him. Whether he thinks this is that or not is, I guess he can speak on that at some point, maybe here on Baseball Barbacast. But I think we know that Lucas has been staying ready. We know that he wanted to go pitch for a team that was going to let him be in the rotation, obviously, with no doubt about it. And I think the Padres are a great opportunity for him to do that. Michael King and Vasquez have been great. Beyond that, because Pivetta is now injured and Joe Musgrove had a setback in his return from Tommy John that doesn't seem like he's coming back anytime soon. We know Yu Darvish is kind of off, just completely off the radar at this point. He's on the restricted list and not coming back at all. So behind King and Vasquez, it's Buehler, it's knuckleballer Matt Waldron and Germán Márquez, who has looked slightly better than he did at the end in Colorado, but not good to the point where it's like, great, he's definitely going to be in our rotation. So which of Buehler, Waldron, Márquez does Lucas end up replacing the next couple of weeks? I'm not exactly sure, but he should improve this rotation once he is, joins the group.
A question that I've gotten from many people, and I'm sure you have gotten from many people. Oh, I got Jordan. 3-2-1. A question that I've gotten from many people, and I'm sure you have gotten a lot, is what took Lucas so long? Why it mid-April and Lucas no job? And I think there's a couple different things going on there. One is that as good as the surface stats were in Boston last year, 3.41 ERA and 145 with 26 starts, the peripherals were not good, right? And that's the strikeout numbers. That's the FIP, that's the WHIP, you know, however you pick it apart. If you want, you can convince yourself that Lucas Giolito, based upon the underlying metrics, is not worth employing. I think there's that. And then I think there's just a dynamic of, you know, maybe the stuff, what, if you looked at the stuff, it's not just like the underlying metrics, the stuff last year did not blow you away, right? And so I could understand why a team was maybe a little bit more hesitant to give him that big contract that he was looking for. And now Lucas just has to go out and prove it. Now, from his perspective, I'm sure, and let me just be clear, this is not like something he has communicated to us as someone that we know well. But like, I'm sure from his perspective, it's like, damn, I got outs. Like, where's my job? Right? I had a 3-4-1 in 145. I should, like, that should get me a 2-year deal, you know? But it is just a reminder of where our game's at. Where, like, you're not necessarily getting paid for what you did. You're getting paid for what people think that who you are will do and what you will be.
Yeah. And I think that the other part of it, and we know this talking to players that have been free agents, is naturally, they're looking around at other pitchers that are getting jobs who had worse seasons than Lucas Giolito last year.
Right.
And this is where what is being sought from a contract standpoint is going to factor into who signs and who doesn't. But you can understand it being pretty natural to look around at some of the other pitchers who did not have a 3-4 last year in 26 starts, who were finding spots into rotations, not just as minor league invites with a chance in spring training. Guys that were given, and some of whom are on the Padres. Right?
Michael King. Michael King last year had a seven. He threw 73 innings with a 3-4-4, right? And like, yes, there are differences.
Yeah.
There are big differences. I'm not saying there are differences. Like, there are injuries, I understand. But like, if you just put them up next to each other, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, this probably goes a different way. But good for Lucas.
Sure.
Having a job is much better than not having a job. Anything else on this, or should we talk about the Mets for a quick second?
No, I mean, we should just say that the Padres have a really good record, and Lucas is now a really important part of their season as they try and not just make the postseason, but, you know, make the Dodgers sweat and stuff. I mean, this is not some panic move where they're a game under 500 and he's coming in to just stable. Like, no, they're really good, and he could be a big part of them continuing to be very good. So
they're good. They're not. I remain unconvinced, and maybe that's not fair.
I'm relatively unconvinced. I don't disagree with you.
The offense is not that good, right? As a team, they've got a 90 OPS plus, a 682 OPS, which even in, you know, Petco is not great. They're not really hitting home runs still. Fernando Tatis Jr. has not gone yard. They have three everyday players that are above average offensively. Bogarts, Ramon Laureano, who I am in on, and Duhar, Merrill, blah, Tatis, blah, Machado, blah. And like, especially with Machado, like, I'm worried that we're starting to see the beginning of the decline here. So again, good for the Padres. I'm not trying to be a hater. The bullpen's incredible. I picked them to not make the playoffs at the beginning of the season, and I'm not changing my tone on that right now.
So I'm with you on that. So did I. I also picked them to miss him. I was low on San Diego. All your points are valid. I'm just saying they're 17-8, and if more of those good players start playing better, they've given themselves a cushion to where they can be very relevant in this conversation. Okay, let's talk about the New York Mets, who have not given themselves a cushion by any stretch. The opposite situation.
What's the opposite? They did of finally a win it.
Yeah.
A
yeah.
Hole? A pit?
That's they are not comfortable, is this simplest way to put it.
A sofa of thorns?
But they have won a baseball game, Jake. Not just one, two.
They won two.
Two whole baseball games. A series win for the New York Mets over the Minnesota Twins. You got to start somewhere. Got to start somewhere as they take two of three from the Minnesota Twins. It was not pretty, as we will get to later in our Ugla. But we'll save the Brazoban stuff for later. The point is, okay, great, Soto's back, you win a series. Oh, just kidding, Francisco Lindor now out with the calf strain. So that point I made when we talked about Soto earlier this week, and I was like, wow, I can't wait to see how this lineup starts to really come together. Nope, doesn't matter. Now I think the guy I am thinking about is the one you see on your screen right now if you're watching on YouTube. It's Bo Bichette, who had the huge swing last night on a ridiculous Anthony Bonda slider, like, a full foot above the zone. It was
eyes.
One of those great examples of Bo Bichette, unbelievable bat to ball skills and power and just unique hitting ability. And
like,
also someone that's going to chase
before the pitch. Right. And he's like, I'm swinging at this pitch. The pitch that comes, I will swing at it. But he can. The difference between like him and Luis Arraez, right, is that like Bo can do that and then hit the ball hard. Right. He could swing at a pitch by his eyes and then hit the nuts out of it. Whereas Arraez, it's like, oh, that pitch is in the other batter's box. Let me just touch it.
Tap it. Yeah. So Bo is the one I am thinking about now. And maybe that will jumpstart him. I especially think, was he batting leadoff last night? I know that Mendoza has shuffled the lineup a good bit. Carson Benj finally getting on the board with another home run. Beatty with the big swing. Mauricio is now back up. I'm excited to see Ronnie Mauricio actually get some playing time. That's something I've been wanting for the last few years. So look, they are a team with a eight and nine and sixteen. Okay, that's a really bad record. So they got a lot of work to do, but they got the Rockies, they got, you know, the Angels, and there's an opportunity here. And I'm Bobichet's the one they I'm thinking about if Lindor's going to be out this long.
Yeah, they got time, bro. That's the biggest thing they got. Lindor on the IL, Ronnie Mauricio up. He's probably going to be playing shortstop most of the time, not Bichette. I like that move. Kind of keep Bo where he's at. His defense has been good. We had this whole thing with Juan Soto saying he didn't talk to his teammates during his IL stint. I was there for that. It was weird that he said it. I think it was sort of a miscommunication where he thought it was like, did you speak to them, their faces, and not like text? Even if he didn't text them, I really don't think it's that weird. When guys are on the IL, they're like in a different universe, man. Especially when teams are on the road, it's just like a different thing. And so, look, there's enough weird, bad things going on with the Mets that we don't need to turn Juan Soto not hitting up the group chat into anything significant.
What do people want him to do? Like, after they lose again on the road, for him to text him like, nice try,
hang
guys!
Hang in there! Muscle emoji! Believe in you guys. Yeah, prayer was, hands.
When I saw this clip, I was like, oh no, this is going to be the dumbest 4 hours relatively on this timeline in quite some time. And it was. And we move past it. So the Mets have other problems. Juan Soto not texting his teammates when on the road is not one of them. Yeah, so the Mets, they got time. But I am questioning David Stearns, not just his whole roster construction, but am I seeing this right? He demoted the MVP to AAA. Is that correct?
Austin Warren, who received MVP chance the other day for striking out the side. Maybe he's going to now be the MVP of the International League. Justice for Austin Warren. I have a feeling he'll be back up in no time, as the Mets bullpen could certainly use the help, and he's been good. So, David Stearns, why you send the MVP to AAA?
Yeah, I don't understand that at all.
It's
okay,
like, you know, when you play fantasy, when you play fantasy baseball and there are players in your team that you're not allowed to drop, like there are the undroppables. Mm-hmm. The MVP should be undroppable. That's all I'm saying.
Once you get MVP chance, you get officially designated as undroppable.
How many guys on the Mets apparently, have received MVP not. Chance this year? One. That's actually a great thing that we should keep track of all year. How many players get MVP chance? Because it's different than getting MVP votes, obviously. It's a smaller group, I think. Like Schwarber got a lot of them last year in Philly. But let's just, if you're at a game or you're watching a game and you hear MVP chants, please send them our way. It's obviously very early. But I guess the question is, like, is he the only player to get MVP chants already? Because even like Otani or Judge, you're not thinking about them as the MVP, right? You see what I'm saying?
I think you still are. I would guess that you still get some carryover residual ones the year after if you are the reigning MVP, I would guess. Now, whether that counts, you can debate. I do think that it is normally something you see later in the season as you start to make your case. You know, has Yordan gotten them in Houston yet? That would not surprise me.
Yeah.
But we will. So let us know. That is a good point. Is Austin Warren alone right now?
You never get Cy Young chance. It's just harder to chant. Cy Young. Cy Young. It just doesn't hit.
Well, how about comeback player of the year chants? We're going to work on those.
Yeah. Rolades relief man of the year.
Right. We are going to take a break. When we return, it's Friday. The Good, the Bad, the Ugly coming right up.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It is Friday, so light your Shabbat candles, put on your white outfit, clean the house, make dinner, get ready for Shabbat, and lock in for the good, the bad, the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, one thing odd, wonky, weird, reminiscent of the one and only Dan Ugla. Jordan Schusterman, there was a doink in a bizarre location this week.
It is not that uncommon to see a home run that is hit off the foul pole, as many people like to point out. Why isn't it the fair pole? Because if you do hit a ball off of it, it is fair and it is a home run. However, O'Neill Cruz, who appropriately has regularly done things on baseball fields that we have never seen before, has decided to take home runs off the foul pole to a whole new level. As earlier this week in Texas, this dude hit a home run that somehow, defying all logic and physics and reasoning, hit the top. I don't know how much space you would say is the size of the top of the foul pole, but it hit off the top of the foul pole, which is preposterous. This should not be a thing that is physically possible. And yet, of course, O'Neill Cruz did this because he hits home runs that make you say, huh? How did he do that?
I think it's the circumference of like a Weber grill. You know, like that's... These things are always bigger than you think, dude. They're like street signs.
Yeah.
You know how big signs are on the highway? I mean,
you're right.
This is not like the size of a pot.
That's true, but you can see one of the most amazing things about this. You can see the mark that the baseball made on top of the pole, and that does give it some size reference that makes me think it's a little bit smaller than what you're describing. But either way, this is O'Neill Cruz out here doing trick shots in the middle of Major League Baseball games. And that's exactly who I would expect to be doing that. So this is so good. He has been so good, which should not be ignored. Yes, he continues to strike out a billion times. And yes, he continues to be a very bad center fielder. But if you're hitting the ball this hard this often and you're drawing some amount of walks, like he walked a lot more last year, and unfortunately the strikeouts were just so bad. But he's at the point now, kind of like with Murakami, where when you're doing that much damage when you are making contact, even if you're not making that much contact, you can be a very impactful player. And that's what we've seen so far. He's got 8 homers and 10 steals. So he might just go 30-30 pretty comfortably.
This is also a great reminder, folks, to clean your surfaces, to dust your home. The top of this pole is a pigsty, a thin layer of grime, grit, dirt, dust on the top of the pole here is gross, dude. Now, not something that is easy to clean or needs to ever be cleaned. And I'm happy it wasn't cleaned because now we have this, you know, the photo evidence of ball hit and pole. But it is just a reminder, like every once in a while, grab a microfiber, wipe down those surfaces.
Well said, sir. All right. What is good for you this week?
The New York Yankees are pushing back against tradition. They are embracing modernity. They are saying, oh, your history? Yeah, it's history. Players on the New York Yankees this week, this is via Brendan Cuddy of The Athletic. Yankee players recently pitched higher ups on the idea of wearing alternate road jerseys for the first time in franchise history, league sources tell The Athletic. Okay, so the Yankees only wear 2 jerseys. They wear their pinstripes at home. They wear their grays on the road. They have worn like the players' weekend uniforms in the past, the all whites that one year, and then there was a navy top they wore with all the nicknames in the back. But the players want to wear like a navy one that they wear during spring training a lot. And to me, this is both good and bad. These uniforms, the navy tops, are boring and not worth the consternation that they've caused. Like they're, I don't think these uniforms, I know you don't care about uniforms. I don't think that these uniforms are worth breaking the tradition for, right? Like, you have this very unique thing where you only wear these two uniforms and it makes you different and it is both pompous and real. Don't get rid of that for just the Navy t-shirt, right? However, for the players going up the chain to request something like this, feeling empowered enough to do that, I think is really cool. And Aaron Judge had a great quote that was like, tradition, we have a, you know, we have a insurance patch on our sleeves. They have an ad on their sleeves. We left the magic of yesteryear a long time ago. And so I do think it is time that the Yankees add another uniform. Hopefully they'll add a City Connect at some point. Whatever it is, people will have very strong thoughts about it. And for me, as someone who makes my money talking about the sport, I think that's good.
I agree. I am really interested in this, even as someone who doesn't really care about uniforms, but in the context of City Connects. And I do remember when they did wear the Players Weekend ones, that was a, people were not happy about that. But no, that was a league initiative. That wasn't, I don't remember the players in particular being like, I'm so excited to wear these, or it wasn't their idea, right? And so in this case, if Judge and others are like, Stanton is like, yeah, let's have new uniforms, we're going to find out how much pull they have, because this alone makes me think that a City Connect is possible someday, like in a way that maybe I didn't before. And we will see who wins that battle. I feel like when you realize, oh, wait, we can make so much money if we make it. But also, you want to make it, you want to make it good. You don't want to get clowned. My guess is if the Yankees ever do a City Connect, it will be as conservative as you possibly could make it. But you'd still probably make a lot of money. So anyway, yeah. I do think this is good and nice to see the Yankees speaking up about something that matters a lot to them. All right, let's go to bad. My bad this week is the Miami Marlins controlling the running game. This is from Fish on First, quality Marlins blog, who pointed out a couple days ago that the Marlins opponents are 35 for 37 on stolen base attempts this year. Nobody has been caught since April 6th. Yikes. Now, this is something that I wanted to bring up because, and I think they actually did maybe catch someone the other day, because it looks like they have three.
Liam Hicks
stealing.
Got someone. They're 35 for 38 now.
Okay, 35 for 38 now. The main character here, unfortunately, is Augustin Ramirez, who has been very bad. Really across the board, certainly defensively, has not really been hitting like I think they wanted. But I bring this up because for my bold prediction this year for the Marlins, which ended up being Sandy Alcantara traded in April, which, by the way, running out of time on that one, I almost did Marlins become first team in, I think, 25 years to allow 200 stolen bases. Last year, they allowed 191. At an 89% clip, which is one of the worst marks of all time. The record in the modern era for most stolen bases allowed is the 2001 Red Sox, who allowed 223 steals, but that was at an 82% clip. Right now, as we see them allowing, you know, they're on pace for around that number at a 92-93% clip. So this is bad. This is something. And you, also, if you're wondering, okay, well, how does this compare to the rest of the league? Is this that many more? Well, the Rays have allowed 32 steals at an 89% clip. The Mets have only allowed 8 steals all season. So if you're looking for something that the Mets are doing right, they are controlling the running game. Mariners and Brewers have also only allowed 9 while preventing 9 apiece. So that's a huge discrepancy in extra bases here. And in this modern era where steals are up and stealing should be easier, there are some teams that are finding ways to prevent it. And then there are other teams who have no idea how to stop it. And I think that's interesting and bad.
There are a couple different ways to break this down. And if the Marlins were a more respectfully relevant team, maybe I'd spend the time. Maybe I will anyway. Is this on the pitchers or is this on the catchers? Because they have equal responsibility when it comes to controlling the running game. Do the Marlins pitchers take a long time to get to the plate? Are they bad at holding runners? Are they more focused on throwing really hard, which often takes more time to like move to the plate, right? Mm-hmm. Or do their catchers stink? Are their arms bad? Are their pop times slow? Like, is this related to them not calling the pitches? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. It's very interesting, and it is very weird. My bad this week. The Boston Red Sox stink, brother. They will be in Baltimore this weekend. I will go see them today. I will say, hey, guys, Jake Mintz here, Yahoo Sports. Why do you stink? And they will say, I don't know why we stink. And I'll say, I know why you stink. They just got swept at home by the Yankees for the first time in a three-game set, 2021. They scored three runs all series. They have the second worst record in the American League. They're seven games back in the AL East. They are last in slugging, second to last in homers, last in ex-WOBA, last in ex-slug, last in expected average. Durbin, Duran, Trevor Story, all awful. Marcelo Meyer, Roman Anthony, plain old bad. Only have four guys with an OPS over 700. That's Yoshida, Wong, Contreras, and Abreu. Only Contreras and Abreu are playing every day of that quartet. Roman Anthony now has back spasms. We're getting F. John Henry, the owner, fire Breslow and sell the team chance in the neighborhood outside Fenway Park, courtesy of a friend of the program, Liam Fennessy. Boy, oh boy, things are messy in Beantown. This is not going well. There was a big concern heading into the year that they'd put too much pressure, too much, relying too heavily on Roman Anthony to be special right away. And he has not been special right away. And that has kind of caused this offense to be genuinely abysmal in the early going.
The one move that they made this offseason that I did think didn't get enough love, Wilson Contreras, has been great. Everything else, including Ranger Suarez, including Caleb Durbin, Crochet. Unfortunately, Crochet, for sure. I mean, that's kind of its own conversation separate from the offseason, but that he's certainly been very disappointing. It's been a mess. Oviedo, obviously, right? It's been Sonny Gray, who's now on the injured list, and that's one where he wasn't exactly dominating beforehand. It is not going well, and if you're going to build it, your team on pitching and defense, and the defense, I guess, has rated pretty well, at least by the advanced metrics, if you can't score to this degree, it doesn't really matter. And they're not exactly pitching it well either. So what are the Red Sox good at right now? I think that's a question you kind of have to ask. And what are they going to start being good at? This has been really ugly. And now they have this road trip to Baltimore, you mentioned, to Toronto, and then they come home for Houston. But this lineup is just brutal. I mean, they have 14 home runs, which is tied with the Giants for the fewest in baseball. When they welcome Houston a week from today, will they have more home runs than Yordan Alvarez, who is just three behind them at 11? I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah.
But I don't know for sure. We will see how it goes. And optics wise, when you get your ass kicked at home by the Yankees, that certainly is not going to make your fans happy. Bad.
Pantoli, Connelly Early, though. Both good.
They're good.
Connor Wong should not be leading the Red Sox in batting average. Okay, Jordan, what's Ugla for you?
My Ugla is Brandon Phillips, who will today or tomorrow will sign a one-day contract with the Cincinnati Reds and retire a Red, which on its face is like, okay, what? Yeah, Brandon Phillips, of course. He played Cincinnati forever, and they love him there, and he's going into the Reds Hall of Fame. That's great. I just didn't know you could still do the whole one-day contract thing years and years after you've been done playing.
Sure.
That part is a little strange. I don't know why he needs to do this. I'm also just wanted to bring up the concept of the one-day contract, and I would love to understand what that means. What is that? Is he officially a minor leaguer for one day? What is this contract? Well, what is written in these one-day contracts? Why do we do them? Does anyone, is it performative? Is it just like for the photo op? I don't know why this part is necessary, but it always gets my attention. And in this case in particular, I thought it was pretty funny. So do you have any thoughts on one day contracts?
I'd like a contract one day.
I just want to know what are the legal components?
Like, are they sending him to Louisville?
On his roster bio, will it say like assigned to Arizona Complex League? Like, he's obviously not taking up a 40 man spot. We know that. So what is the origin of the one day contract? I think these are all things we can maybe.
Now, this one is funny because Brandon Phillips has not appeared in the big league since 2018. He's not appeared for the Reds since 2016. I believe after retiring, he did play indie ball for a while. Mexican League in 19. Atlantic League in 21 and 22.
This was the other thing I wanted to bring up about this, is it also reminded me of Brandon Phillips when he did sign with the Lexington Legends. Press release. Do you remember this? I think we did this for Ugla or on the show. There was a press release when Brandon Phillips at age 40 signed with the Lexington Legends, and the headline said, Lexington Legends signed future MLB Hall of Famer Brandon Phillips. And I remember seeing that at the time, and I was like, am I missing something? Like, did I not realize how good Brandon Phillips was? Because I watched a lot of Brandon Phillips, and I thought he was really good, not a future Hall of Famer. Since then, Brandon Phillips has appeared on the Hall of Fame ballot and did receive one vote. Jake, Brandon Phillips did receive one Hall of Fame vote. That does not make him a future MLB Hall of Famer. In fact, while he is going to be
future
a
future Hall of Fame vote recipient,
which does not sound as good in the press release. But I did want to shout out, because I looked into this, because I don't think we've talked about this since this happened. And the one guy that gave Brandon Phillips a Hall of Fame vote was Rick Talander, a Chicago columnist, I believe Chicago Sun-Times, a veteran columnist. And he gave this quote. Our friends of the program, Zach Meisel and Sam Blum, did a story about guys that got one Hall of Fame vote. And they got this quote from Rick about voting for Brandon Phillips. And I just love this. This is also very ugly. This is just great. Because this isn't even really about Brandon Phillips. It's just like why he votes
for Rick.
Quote, "When you get down to this, we don't need humans to vote at all. With war, with whip, with every imaginable statistic, you can come up with things that never existed before. An algorithm could tell us who's worthy. You don't really even need humans. So I go on what I felt. To me, that's the most human thing there is." Sure, wow. Man.
I wonder what that guy thinks about the Marlins calling pitches from the dugout or ABS.
Oh, yes. I'm
sure he loves both.
Who's to say? But somehow,
when you're saying we got all these stats, these newfangled stats like whip, brother, whip. You want to criticize war? Criticize war. That's fine. I get it. Anti-war. WHIP is like not a math. It's barely a math problem. Walks.
That's like some day
hits,
one stuff.
Innings pitched. Okay. Yeah. A fourth grader, a second grader, a smart kindergartner could do it. So if you're intimidated by WHIP, whew, you must have a tough time waking
you know
up
what?
In the world.
Brandon Phillips, zero career WHIP. It's pretty good.
That's never whipped.
Never.
Whipless.
Never allowed a walk or a hit in or an inning pitched at any point. So anyway, Brandon Phillips, one-day contracts, a lot of ugly in there. So let us know if you know anything about one-day contracts.
Speaking of innings pitched, my ugly this week is Huascar Brazoban, who in last night's Mets game came in a tough spot in the eighth inning and proceeded to give up a nut-crushing, gut-wrenching, back-breaking, game-tying grand salami to Ryan Jeffers in the eighth inning. The Mets then took the lead in the bottom half, and Brazoban came back out for the ninth. But wait, he's not supposed to? What's going on? Here's the deal, friends. Inning over. Mets up 10-7. Vibes are great. City Field's rocking. Devin Williams' music comes on. Huascar Brazoban walks out of the dugout onto the field. And what that means is that if you cross the line, you have to pitch to the first batter. And so Devin Williams walked out of the bullpen because he was told he was going in the game and heard his music and whatever. And then had to hit a U-turn and skedaddle right back into the pen as Waskar Brazoban was forced to face the first batter of the inning, which he did. And he retired that hitter on a ground out. Carlos Mendoza then walks out, pulls him, puts in Devin Williams, who is awful in the ninth inning. Again. And struggles and gives up a run and barely survives, gets two outs. Game over. After the game, turns out that this was on Brazoban. He said, quote, he was on autopilot after being frustrated, giving up a grand slam in the eighth, just came back out for the ninth. Honestly, he said, it was really my bad. Yes, Waskar. Yes, indeed it was. This is so ugly, Jordan. And I will tell a story now. I once did this. This once happened to me in my playing career. Okay. In high school, during a high school game, I was playing shortstop, all right? And my good friend Michael was pitching. And I went out to the mound at like the start of the fourth inning and like as a joke picked up the ball and like got on the rubber like I was getting ready to pitch. And if you pick up the ball on the rubber, you have to face the first batter, apparently. I learned. So going in there totally dry, I faced one batter. I guess they got out. Michael went to shortstop, and then we switched back because neither of us left the game, so you could just go back and forth to the mound. So I did do this one time, and you feel like such an idiot. It's so bad.
But what you just described is way crazier than Brazoban thinking he was supposed to go back out, which is how Carlos Mendoza described it afterwards, being like, yeah, we told him he would still be in if the game was tied, and then we just never followed up, I guess, that they took the lead. And so Brazoban just went back out there. But what you're describing is so interesting. I never knew that. And now it makes me think about what infielder in the big leagues would do this by accident during...
Jazz Chisholm Jr. Jazz Chisholm Jr.
visit.
Jazz.
Because I had no idea. Can you imagine, dude, was a rule.
Like Garrett Cole's going out there for the third inning. Jazz like picks up the ball. He's like, oh. And then like Garrett has to go like play left field for a batter.
I'm thinking that the most logical, the way I'm seeing it would be mound visit, or you know what it would be? It would be like a guy maybe gets hurt slightly. And you're kind of waiting for that to sort itself out. And the infielder, it's not like a serious injury, but you're kind of just waiting for the guy to figure his stuff out before he gets back on the mound. And then an infielder, you know, with severe ADD just like picks up the ball and wanders over and steps on the mound. And in that case, that's literally Jake Mintz, what I just described as you. So that is what it takes, I think, to end up in that predicament.
The moral of the story here is take your meds in the morning so that you don't go out and do a dumb joke that, you know, complicates your high school baseball game. That's our show. Thank you to Ingrid Rosas and Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you to Jordan Schusterman for co-hosting. Thank you to the Buffalo Sabres, who won game three of the hockey wildcard round last night. 2-1 in Boston. Blade Gang forever. Okay. Sabre. Oh, it's upside down. Sabres rule, baby. Sabres rule, Bruins drool. That's all I got to say. A power play goal would be nice.
Oh, I was about to say, who needs the power play? But we'll get there at some point. But until then, enjoy the baseball this weekend. A lot of interesting series going on, including the Padres and D-backs in Mexico City. Just a couple of games in that one. So we will recap all that and more on Monday. But until then, thank you for listening to Baseball Barbercast. We'll talk to you soon.